Valley News.
Russia says it won't pause its military action in Ukraine, even as the Austrian chancellor visits Moscow.
He will ask Vladimir Putin to establish humanitarian corridors out of some of those besieged Ukrainian cities like Mariupol.
Plus, the UN warns of growing concern over access to healthcare in Ukraine.
Destruction of health facilities, the lack of access to health facilities, people on the move, people living in shelters and basements and crowded together puts everybody at risk for infectious diseases.
And later in the program, as sanctions continue severing Russia's ties to the global economy, what impact could a default on its foreign debt have? Today is Monday, April 11th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Monday said that Moscow will not pause its military operation in Ukraine for subsequent rounds of peace talks. That statement comes as Austrian Chancellor Karl Nehammer met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. In London, Henry Ridgewell is closely following the developments.
Nehammer says that his visit is aimed at telling Vladimir Putin that Russia has already lost the war morally, in a moral sense, because of some of the alleged atrocities that have been carried out, because of the high number of civilian deaths. How that message will go down with Vladimir Putin in Moscow, one can only guess at the moment. This is a meeting behind closed doors. So he will ask Vladimir Putin to establish humanitarian corridors out of some of those besieged Ukrainian cities like Mariupol. He will ask for a general ceasefire and a full investigation of alleged war crimes that Russian forces have carried out. This seems like a bit of a wish list of Western demands of Russia, but the Austrian leader said that it is a moral duty of those in power to confront the Russian leader and to continually bring up these issues and demand a cease to hostilities.
Henry, I also want to ask you about the EU ministers. They're meeting to discuss the fighting in Ukraine on Monday as well. It follows visits to Ukraine by Joseph Borrell as well as EU President Ursula von der Leyen. What can you tell us about what's going on in those discussions?
That's a meeting taking place today in Luxembourg, where EU foreign ministers will look to build on some of the agreements that were secured last week at the NATO and G7 foreign ministers level in Brussels. They will look, first of all, at ways that they can support Ukraine financially in humanitarian aid terms, but also how the EU might aid Ukraine's military as well. That's an area that the European Union is stepping into that it hasn't so much so far. That's generally been NATO's domain. So the meeting being chaired by Josep Borrell, who visited Kiev at the weekend with Ursula von der Leyen. They visited Bucha, north of Ukraine, where mass graves have been found, where alleged civilian massacres were carried out by Russian forces there. So we are expecting some results of that meeting later today. Some European states have, outside of European Union and NATO administration, if you like, given their own weapons to Ukraine already.
VOA's Henry Ridgewell reporting from London. Russia said on Monday that it had destroyed an S-300 missile defense system that Slovakia gave Ukraine last week. However, that assessment is disputed not only by the Slovakian government, but Ukraine and the United States as well. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the South Korean National Assembly on Monday, saying that Russia's war was not just to conquer Ukraine, and urged the South Korean government to provide his country with arms to help defend it against Russia's invasion. In addition, Britain's defense ministry said Russian forces continued shelling the Donetsk and Luhansk regions in eastern Ukraine, and Ukraine's defense ministry added that Russia has nearly completed its buildup of forces for a renewed assault on the Donbass. And Canada also imposed new sanctions on companies in the Russian defense sector and is studying options for additional measures in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Millions have fled Ukraine since the start of Russia's invasion, and that's according to United Nations data. The vast majority are women and children, populations that are especially vulnerable to human trafficking. Anna Rice narrates the story.
This is the Ukrainian-Polish border, the Shehini-Medyka checkpoint. According to the latest UN data, a large proportion of Ukrainian refugees, mostly women and children, fled to Poland after Russia invaded Ukraine. Many spent days waiting to cross the border.
It's very tough, of course. I don't know what else to say, but we have no choice. We need to save the children.
Since the very start of Russia's aggression, human rights activists have been warning refugees that they could be targeted by human traffickers.
The risks have definitely increased, mostly because women who cross the border with children have found themselves in an extremely vulnerable position from an economic point of view as well as psychological. They are fleeing a war. People are easier to manipulate when they are in such a state.
Human rights activist Yulia Anosova says human trafficking typically involves both sexual exploitation and violence. Polish police have already registered 2 cases of rape among refugees. Volunteers are working to inform women who might be at risk.
We've seen men taking pictures of women and teenage girls. We very quickly understood that human traffickers could be behind this.
A woman from the Kiev region was looking for a job in Lviv. She found an employment ad, got in touch with a person of contact who offered her a job as a nanny for a 15-year-old boy. Part of the job was offering sexual services.
Refugees also risk being exploited at work. The scheme is very simple. Living quarters may be offered for free at first, and once the refugees arrive, they find out it's anything but free. Human rights activists emphasize such actions are illegal.
If there is an expectation for work, then the work should be paid. And very important. Moreover, if you have to work in the place where you live, or if there is the same owner that requires you to work, I don't know, in a hotel, in a, I don't know, farm or whatever, and you are being hosted, that is a sign that you need to be, you know, to be aware that this is a vulnerable situation.
Half of the displaced Ukrainians are children. Some cross the border without any papers. Some cross the border alone, without parents. Such children are at risk of ending up with someone suspicious, or worse.
Missing is a result of gaps in the protection system, and gaps in the protection system lead are the same kinds of issues that attract traffickers.
The organization called Missing Children Europe asks refugees to immediately report any missing children using their hotline. They also encourage adults to be watchful, and if they see a child looking lost and alone in the street, to immediately alert local authorities. For women, there is also advice about how not to become a victim of human traffickers.
Ask for an ID card, identifying them, if they have some car from the organization or something like that, to go to the tent to see if they have a tent. It's very important. If they have a tent with their name in the border, it means that it's a safe organization.
Experts also advise refugees to take pictures of important documents on their phone, stay in a group, and keep handy the phone number for the police in any country they enter. It's also important to have contact information for volunteers and aid groups, and keep in touch with relatives and close friends so that as many people as possible know the location of each refugee. For Lesia Bakalets in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
The United Nations Security Council continued those discussions on Monday with UNICEF's director, Manuel Fontaine, providing this update.
Inside Ukraine, children and families and communities are under attack. Of the 3.2 million children estimated to have remained in their homes, nearly half may be at risk of not having enough food. Attacks on water system infrastructure and power outages have left an estimated 1.4 million people without access to water in Ukraine. Another 4.6 million people have only limited access. The situation is even worse in cities like Mariupol and Kherson, where children and their families have now gone weeks without running water and sanitation services, a regular supply of food and medical care. They are sheltering in their homes and underground, waiting for the bombs and violence to stop. As of yesterday, the High Commissioner for Human Rights Office has verified 142 children killed and 229 children injured. We know these numbers are likely much higher.
Now updating us more on Monday's Security Council meeting is VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir.
So the point of Monday's meeting was to talk about the plight of women and children, particularly in Ukraine, because, as we know, the refugee population that's fleeing Ukraine is 90% women and children, and it puts them at extraordinary risk. You have mothers without their husbands beside them to protect them, not just from regular violence, from bombs and things, but now a heightened risk of sexual violence. And we heard from the head of UN Women, Sima Bahous, that there's a lot of conscripts, you know, people who've been drafted into the militaries of Russia and Ukraine, because you have ad hoc groups, but also mercenaries that are there, that there's a lot of brutality against civilians, and they're particularly concerned about women and unaccompanied teenagers.
Margaret, the United Nations General Assembly held a meeting last week that removed Russia from the Human Rights Council. The Security Council has met several times about Ukraine. What's next for the body, since Russia currently is on the UN Security Council with a veto?
Right. So it is very difficult for the Council to do anything because they can't agree. In fact, we saw it again on Monday. Even the Russian complained about the agenda item being used to discuss the situation. You know, so at every turn, they're complaining about the discussion of the situation. I think that at the UN, there's still a lot to be done in the General Assembly and in other venues to keep the pressure and the isolation on Russia. I think that's the strategy of the Western countries. And I also, you know, the UN is really front and center on the humanitarian response. And that's really what the UN does best these days. You know, they can't force political parties to sit down and talk with each other as much as they may want to, but they can get in there and deliver aid and kind of alleviate the humanitarian suffering as much as they can. And they're doing as much as they can. It's been very difficult in Ukraine. They've only gotten about a handful of major convoys out into the country so far because it is such an active military front. But they're definitely, you know, working and doing their best to assist people inside the country and those who fled.
Margaret Bashir is VOA's UN correspondent. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. UN health officials warn more people in Ukraine will start dying from chronic diseases and preventable illnesses than from war injuries the longer that the war goes on. Lisa Schlein is up next.
The World Health Organization says health workers in Ukraine continue to deliver care in the face of unimaginable human suffering and in areas of total devastation. WHO is calling on Russia to enact an immediate ceasefire and to grant unhindered access of humanitarian assistance for those in need. Despite the many constraints, officials say they've been able to deliver 185 tons of medical supplies to the hardest hit areas in the country and have reached 500,000 people with trauma and surgical support and primary health care. Hans-André Kluge, WHO Regional Director for Europe, is in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. He says the escalating war is obstructing efforts to provide medication and treatment to the sick and wounded.
As of today, WHO has verified 91 attacks on health. Routine immunization coverage for polio and measles is below the threshold for population immunity. 50% of Ukraine's pharmacies are presumed closed, and 1,000 health facilities are in proximity to conflict areas or in changed areas of control.
Kluge adds roughly 80,000 babies will be born in the next 3 months. He says they will be missing out on prenatal and postnatal care because of the war. He says attacks on hospitals, ambulances, and medical personnel are a breach of international humanitarian law and must stop. Heather Popowitz, WHO's incident manager in Ukraine, says war is a risk to public health.
With the destruction of health facilities,
facilities, the lack of access to health facilities, people on the move, people living in shelters and basements and crowded together puts everybody at risk for infectious diseases. So all of these puts the most vulnerable at risk, which are the elderly, the children, and the pregnant women.
Papowitz says these risks for those migrating continues through their journey and into other countries of asylum. Latest figures from the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights put the number of civilian casualties at nearly 3,840, including 1,611 killed and 2,227 injured. The UN Migration and Refugee Agency's report, 7.1 million people now are displaced inside Ukraine, and another 4.2 million people have fled to neighboring countries in search of refuge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Sanctions continue pushing Russia closer to defaulting on its international debt as access to reserves held in foreign banks are cut off. Now, while it hasn't happened yet, economists are concerned it may, as Moscow has debt repayments coming up and nearly made one just last week. So what would be the impact, not only for Russia, but for the global community, should Russia default on its debt repayment? Ray Hill is a senior lecturer at Emory University's Gazzetta Business School.
It's not going to have much effect in Western capital markets because the Western financial institutions are not very exposed to Russia anymore. They've been reducing their exposure a lot since the Crimean invasion. But for Russia, the consequences are going to be even worse than in 98 because there's no IMF to come to their rescue.
Clinical assistant professor at Loyola Marymount University, Anna Turgeon, adds, while Russia has defaulted on its international debt before, and that was back in 1917, Moscow's 1998 default was on domestic debt, and
that was a unique time, 1998, because that was basically almost synchronous and close to the Asia financial crisis. Following the Russian default, we saw basically another financial crisis starting in Brazil, followed by the peso-Mexican crisis. So it was quite a bit of instability in emerging markets at that time, particularly the big emerging markets. So that's where this, you know, the Russian default was basically more potentially predictable than it currently is.
Hill adds that while he doesn't foresee any particular short-term effects, should Russia default on foreign debt, however,
it's going to close them off for quite a while from the international capital markets. And so this is just making it more severe and more long-term than the sanctions that we've seen that are already in place.
Turgeon sees that perhaps the biggest impact may be on some countries in Central Asia if Russia defaults, because Central Asia depends on remittance payments.
From, you know, let's say people that are working in Russia and sending money home to countries like, you know, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Georgia would be one of them as well. So they would, in fact, be quite, you know, they'd be the group that would suffer more substantially from this. Now, since you brought up the China and India, if we actually put together all of the what are called the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, those are the largest emerging markets. They actually had started what's called a new development bank, kind of in response against the IMF in about 2012, to basically deal with the situation where, you know, if there was sanctioning by the West in any one of these countries, that they could have their own centralized financial mechanism that would lend in these situations. Now, this system's been around for more than 10 years, and they still have a lot of problems, and there's a lack of transparency and other issues, but I could see this developing further, potentially.
Russia's finance minister said Sunday that Moscow will take legal action if the West tries to force it to default on its sovereign foreign debt, but did not provide any details. Russian President Vladimir Putin has upended decades of relative peace and stability in Europe with his unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. Experts tell VOA he is an ideological leader focused on returning Russia to the superpower status it lost when the Soviet Union collapsed. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain rounds us out with this profile.
Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin was born in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, Russia, in 1952. In 1975, he joined Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, the KGB, and was stationed in Germany before entering politics. In late 1999, Russian President Boris Yeltsin stepped down amid scandal, making Putin acting president in exchange for immunity from prosecution. Putin has held the reins of power in Moscow ever since, winning multiple elections increasingly viewed as rigged, sidestepping term limits, and jailing or attempting to kill his main political opponents, as Michael Kimmage of the German Marshall Fund explains.
Well, there is a long record of journalists and intelligence officers and others who have been murdered, one assumes, at the command of Putin, or at the very least at the command of Putin's underlings.
Putin has cultivated a hyper-masculine image of strength and all-knowing authority. This fits in with his ideological leadership style. Psychology professor Samuel Hunter tells VOA, saying this kind of leader looks to the past.
So they will talk about a time when things were better. They will talk about a time to return to. If you are to follow me as a leader, then we will return to this era where we had greater influence and power and strength. And so, you know, Putin is a great example of that.
Putin wants Russia to be treated like a superpower again. Angela Stent of the Brookings Institution told VOA.
And he believes that the rest of the world should treat Russia as if it were the Soviet Union. He doesn't want to restore the Soviet Union, but he wants to be treated as a great power whose views are respected and where people sort of fear Russia and they accept that Russia has a right to this sphere of influence in its neighborhood.
Kimmich agrees.
I think in his own eyes, he's very much a Russian patriot. So there is a commitment that he has to the Russian past and to Russian greatness that's a motivating force. And certainly the desire for power is a thread. His attraction to the KGB in the first place is a powerful institution.
Despite Russia's relatively weak economy, Putin has engaged in major conflicts around the world and built some strong alliances, which has boosted his popularity at home. Elizabeth Shackelford of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs told VOA.
Well, I think the biggest thing is that he came in and he really kind of did restore Russia to being a major player on the world stage after a time when Russia had really been largely sidelined. And he's done this through punching above his weight, right?
Although he has engaged Russian troops in brutal conflicts, Putin's launching of a full-scale invasion of his neighbor, Ukraine, has surprised many because of the sheer scale of the risk, including former President Barack Obama.
He was always ruthless. You witness what he did in Chechnya. He had no qualms about crushing those who he considered a threat. That's not new. For him to bet the farm in this way, I would not have necessarily predicted from him 5 years ago.
Experts say that since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, Putin has been more alone and isolated than ever, appearing to take extreme precautions in meetings shortly before the invasion with some vaccinated and freshly tested world leaders. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but other news and events from around the world 24 hours a day. You can find that coverage at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of our entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe. And good night.
This is the Voice
of America. Washington, D.C.